Today's episode is dedicated to Brother Mike, still stuck in that cultural membrane. I hope this scratches that itch for you, Mike. You know what I'm talking about. And thanks for your support, brother.
In the faith where I was born was a culture of strict obedience and absolute deference to leaders and faith-promoting stories and cautionary tales and songs and games and beliefs and customs and rituals and certain things you are supposed to wear and certain things you're not supposed to wear and green jello with carrot shavings and yada, 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 yada. And it molded my whole life and surrounded me like a metaphorical cultural membrane. But then I poked around at all this stuff, 'cause something just didn't feel quite right. And it cracked and finally broke, and then I broke out of my metaphorical cultural membrane.
We all live in a cultural membrane, a cultural membrane, a cultural membrane. We all live in a cultural membrane, a cultural membrane, a cultural membrane. Hey. We all live in a cultural membrane, a cultural membrane, a cultural membrane.
Hey,
we all live in a cultural membrane.
Yeah, you get the point, right?
This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the Quorum.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and today you're going to hear a conversation between myself and Matt as we watch a YouTube video that was a TED Talk done in 2014. I think I said 2012 a couple of times during the conversation. It was actually 2014. Jonathan Haidt, he's talking about this idea of cultural membranes, and Matt and I go off on a few tangents. And I don't know, I think it's a really good conversation and a great video. I mean, great message from Jonathan Haidt. As you know, I'm a big fan. So anyway, without any further ado, here it is. Thanks, guys. Do you see just, like, do you see this over here?
Yeah, I see that whole...
Do you want me to expand it?
I don't give a shit. Whatever you want to do.
Okay. No, I'll just do this. So... if there's ever a point where you want me to stop, just go, hang on, stop, and we'll talk.
Okay. Let's practice. Hang on, stop. That was a pretty cool visual.
That worked great.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Good job.
I have a question for you. Are you religious? Please raise your hand right now if you think of yourself as a religious person.
Should we answer that question?
Yeah, are you raising your hand?
I'm raising my hand.
You are?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'm not, but because I know what's coming next.
See, that's not fair.
That's okay, dude. If you're proud to be religious and raise your hand, then raise your hand and be religious.
I will raise my hand and be religious.
All right.
Okay, let's see. I'd say about 3 or 4%. I had no idea there were so many believers at a TED conference. Okay, here's another question. Do you think of yourself as spiritual in any way, shape, or form? Raise your hand. Okay, that's the majority.
All right. So you're still cool with, like, the religious versus the spiritual?
Yes.
Wow. Why? What's the difference for you?
Religion has more of a form, has more of a structure.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So like, organized religion?
It doesn't have to be. I think there can be an unorganized religion.
So there's no form or structure to spirituality?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, cool. All right. Let's go.
My talk today is about the main reason, or one of the main reasons, why most people consider themselves to be spiritual in some way, shape, or form. My talk today is about self-transcendence. It's just a basic fact about being human, that sometimes the self seems to just melt away.
Have you ever had that kind of experience, Matt, where the self just melts away?
You know, I'll be honest, I'm seeking for it. I think I've been close.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've, right. I think I understand that. I certainly understand the idea, but it's something I'm always striving for.
Okay. And I think the way that he goes on to explain it, you'll go, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I've done that before.
So mm-hmm.
it happens. The feeling is ecstatic. And we reach for metaphors of up and down to explain these feelings. We talk about being uplifted or elevated. Now, it's really hard to think about anything abstract like this without a good concrete metaphor. So here's the metaphor I'm offering today. Think about the mind as being like a house with many rooms, most of which we're very familiar with. But sometimes it's as though a doorway appears from out of nowhere.
You know, I just want to, on that metaphor, mm-hmm. if the mind is a, you know, there's rooms, he says many we're familiar with. I think a few we're familiar with. Most are totally unexplored, you know, like the subconscious. Like, I don't know what percentage of our brain is conscious and what percentage is unconscious, but I'd say the vast majority is unconscious, unfamiliar, unexplored. We're not even aware of what we're carrying around and what's influencing us.
Yeah. And disconnected. I mean, even the two different rooms could be happening and that conscious connection isn't being made, you know, being made so that they're really comprehended or understood. I was just watching the movie Lucy with Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Oh, really recommend it. That's basically the premise is that what if humans could use more than whatever the 10-15% that.
Oh, is that the one where she has like her eyes change color?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I remember seeing the previews for it.
Yeah. I think it's an underappreciated film.
Okay.
But yeah, I agree with you.
All right. I will watch Lucy.
All right.
And it opens onto a staircase. We climb the staircase and experience a state of altered consciousness. In 1902, the great American psychologist William James wrote about the many varieties of religious experience. He collected all kinds of case studies. He quoted the words of all kinds of people who'd had a variety of these experiences. One of the most exciting to me is this young man, Stephen Bradley, had an encounter, he thought, with Jesus in 1820. And here's what Bradley said about it.
Are you sad that he used this Bradley guy instead of Joseph Smith?
No, I'm really interested in what Bradley's experience was. I didn't even think of Joseph Smith quite.
Oh,
frankly.
There's so many. Like, Mormon Expression interviewed the author of, I think his last name was Horowitz, and he wrote a book called Occult America.
Uh huh.
And I remember that was before I was doing anything with Mormon Expression, but it was one of the episodes that just totally turned me on to this whole podcasting thing in the first place. So I went and I got the audio book and listened to it. And there were a lot of people, Joseph Smith was one, but there were a lot of people who were having these kinds of experiences or claiming these kinds of experiences, back then, and even now. So that was really interesting. You know, we usually, I think, get so caught up in our own Mormon bubble that, we don't see how common, some of these experiences are outside of it. But
yeah.
Anyway.
I thought I saw the Savior in human shape for about 1 second in the room, with arms extended, appearing to say to me, "Come." The next day, I rejoiced with trembling. My happiness was so great that I said I wanted to die. This world had no place in my affections. Previous to this time, I was very selfish and self-righteous, but now I desired the welfare of all mankind and could with a feeling heart forgive my worst enemies.
Do you have anything you want to say about that, Matt?
No, not really.
Okay. Really?
I think it's interesting that you know, the reality was for 1 second. That's the thing that I thought. I said, really? Only 1 second?
Yeah. Okay.
But.
So note how Bradley's petty moralistic self just dies on the way up the staircase. And on this higher level, he becomes loving and forgiving. The world's many religions have found so many ways to help people climb the staircase. Some shut down the self using meditation. Others use psychedelic drugs. This is from a 16th century Aztec scroll showing a man about to eat a psilocybin mushroom and at the same moment get yanked up the staircase by a god. Others use dancing, spinning, and circling to promote self-transcendence. But you don't need a religion to get you through the staircase. Lots of people find self-transcendence in nature. Others overcome their self at raves. But here's the weirdest place of all: war. So many books about war say the same thing, that nothing brings people together like war, and that bringing them together opens up the possibility of extraordinary self-transcendent experiences. I'm going to play for you an excerpt from this book by Glenn Gray. Gray was a soldier in the American Army in World War II, and after the war, he interviewed a lot of other soldiers and wrote about the experience of men in battle.
Yeah, this war thing. So I've not seen this before, but there's been something that I've been thinking about recently. I've been trying to zero in on, and how connected we've been and people get by creating divisions and disconnections. I mean, we keep talking about the disconnection, how disconnected this country is, how divided this country is. And in many ways, that's absolutely true.
Put your video back on.
Oh.
I want to see you while you're talking.
Okay.
All the war. Yeah.
Where am I, dude? Sorry. Oh, here we go. Starting to navigate this thing. There we go. All right. So, can you see me?
Uh-huh.
All right. You know, that we talk about how divided the country is, how disconnected we are from one another. But while that's happening, and it is happening, people are becoming more connected in their division.
Right.
Right? I mean, so they're getting
the us versus them thing. Totally.
Yeah, it's providing exactly that thing they say it's destroying, right?
Kind of. Yeah.
I mean, it's a form of it. It's
sure.
And that's really what tribalism ends up being.
It's just another form of it. I like this staircase metaphor that he's using. I think if I'm listening carefully to what he's saying, at the bottom of the staircase, you are an individual. You're alone. At the top of the staircase, you're connected. You're part of another, part of a whole. Mm-hmm. And there's a transformation that can take place as you're ascending that staircase. There's times that we ascend and times we descend. But at the top of that staircase where you're connected to other people, there's a lot of different things that can connect you. And having a common cause, like in war, and that common cause is survival, or it's destroying an enemy, you know, something like that, that this common cause really rallies people together and to do things, not just for their own self-interest, but for the interest of people in a group. And so, yeah, you do see that even with all these little infighting Facebook echo chambers that we've talked about before. And that's this dichotomy. I was watching a documentary last week. Heather recommended it when we were doing the Sapiens discussion. It's called First Contact, and it's about these tribes in the Amazon that come out and make contact. And as I was watching this, I was thinking about this interest, you know, like they would talk about how sometimes they would come out to the borders, or maybe they would just watch from across the river and they would see the white people, and then they would come and they would steal their clothes at night and they would go back, you know, and they were curious about it. And every once in a while there would be a large enough group that they would say, all right, let's attack. And they would try to attack, and then they would get pushed back. And then there would be peace for a while, and a generation or two would go by, they would forget the loss, and then they would go again. And so it's like this pulsating action of pushing against. And I had this idea of, because I've been reading Sapiens and Homo Deus and thinking about human history and evolution, about how we started off in these small groups, these small tribes, and everybody was pretty much doing this with everybody else.
Yeah.
Pulsating, you know, pushing, testing your boundaries. And whether it was through war or through conversion, you know, like we did when we were missionaries, or any other numbers of ways, multiple little tribes would get subsumed into a larger tribe. And he's going to talk a little bit about that, but I it just seems like there's always this tension between bringing people in and seeking for oneness, right, and attacking people on the outside of whatever that oneness right. is.
They are perceived as they're very much the same thing too often, and yeah. and they're indistinguishable.
Yeah, and it was one of those things that, like when I was going through my faith crisis, and I recognized that tension that exists even within our doctrine, and I think it's something that a lot of ex-Mormons are critical of. You know, oh, you say on the one hand love everyone, but then you hate the gays,
right?
You know, it's like it just seems like biologically there's this tension that's built into us. Where, yeah, we love, but we hate. We love, but we hate. And my hope is that as that's pulsating, that it's like always two steps forward, one step back. Two steps forward, one step back, hopefully. But anyway, let's.
I don't know, man. I'm afraid that globalism and populism is just it's breaking that down. That heartbeat yeah. is being crushed.
It's all been moving towards like one global unification. And now we have these tools like the internet that are allowing me to sit in Miami and you to sit in Arizona and have this conversation, recording it that other people are going to be listening to. And, you know, in a way we're connecting across mm-hmm. space and time like we've never been able to before. And, you know, we'll keep pulsing, going forward, going back, going forward, going back. But the internet of all things, man, eventually everything will be able to be connected in ways that we haven't imagined before. So it makes me appreciate, it's not the right word, but get a little bit less disheartened by all of the divisiveness that I see and going, oh, you know what? This is just this part of our nature. We do this. We have been doing this for a long time. And I think taking a big global view that it's moving towards unification, that's very much inspired by Homo Deus.
Yeah.
By what, that.
Yeah. There. Well, okay. So I've been thinking about, you know, that William Bradford's whatever experience about feeling about Jesus. And I have had, I've been thinking about this, the connections and about, you know, in-group, out-group and these things. And it's brought me to the teachings of Jesus and the gospel, mm-hmm. you know, and by that, I mean the
Wait,
things that
is,
are,
this is Matt Long of Infants on Thrones.
It is.
You're saying that. Have you been transformed since the last time you were on the podcast?
I've been transfigured, like upon the Mount Sinai or wherever that was. Where no, you know, it was just I really it started by starting listening to Beatles Love and
yeah.
Really liking those messages and then realizing yeah there were these messages that were really meaningful to me as a kid and that brought me peace. And I understood as being good for other people, you know, the things that were reinforcing. So I've been thinking about those messages and I've gotten a new appreciation for the man Jesus, or at least the myth Jesus, whatever. Mm-hmm. But some of the concepts and the ideas of an embodiment of love, a dude who'd just kind of cool and friends with people, and didn't really care what you did or what you look like or how much money you made, but you had a seat at his table, right? He made you feel safe. He made you feel.
See, it's funny because as you say this, even this tension of love and hate, you even see in the Jesus myth, in the way that that's been put together, because
for sure,
yeah, Jesus is all those things that you've said, but he's also kind of ruthless in some ways. And he says, take your plowshares and form them into swords. And he says, everybody come unto me, but then there's also no unrighteous thing can enter into the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah. So there's this tension
and push and pull.
Yeah. So let me, I understand. And I make this error now when I was talking to my wife about this, as I was talking about what I've been thinking about Jesus. See, the beautiful thing about being as much of an angry atheist as possible.
Yeah.
Is I am so comfortable in creating my own Jesus.
Uh-huh.
So I can cast off those things that were misattributed to him.
Right.
And that don't elevate, that don't enhance, that don't connect. And so it's easy for me to dismiss that and say, yeah, no, I'm not going to be in this box of the Bible. I'm telling you things that ring true to my soul and that elevate me and that connect me to people. That's the Jesus that I follow. And once I get to a point and you say, but Jesus said this, I'm sorry, my friend. I'm not sure what constraints you have on God or what constraints you have on revelation or what constraints you have on my understanding of the universe. That's not my Jesus, friend.
Yeah.
Right? So I do believe in hippie Jesus, like Will Ferrell and Talladega Nights, the baby Jesus is favorite Jesus.
Yeah, right.
Right? The hippie Jesus is my favorite Jesus.
Okay.
Right? And to the extent that, you know, I am inspired by the idea of a guy that has a voice that's articulate ministering to people. You know, the idea of healing people. You know, it's woo-woo magic is what we always focus on, right? Spitting and this type of thing. But isn't he healing by bringing somebody to his table and by making them feel comfortable and safe and entertained for a night? I mean, isn't that social connection that he fostered when he went to parties and those things that people were drawn to him?
And whether he did or not, like, for you, that's what you want to do.
Right.
And that,
well,
I mean,
I don't
that's
want to do it.
But that's what you feel is the right way to be. That's what you admire and you aspire to in that story.
And I connect to the myth of Jesus or the legend or the whatever you want to say, the stories that had meaning to my soul as a kid and as a teenager and as an adult, I can tap back into and say there is value there. There's elevation there. There's connection there. So as I did that, and as I experienced that, I felt embraced by my Jesus, right?
Yeah.
And it's not a magical Jesus, but it's still a wondrous Jesus. And maybe it's Jesus as a concept or as a title, right? But yeah, so I don't know, I'm inspired by by that. And I feel when Will Bradford has that, you know, that experience with the real Jesus, I feel like I understand what that's like.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Is that where you Yeah. Yeah.
All right, let's jump back into the video.
There's a key passage where he basically describes the staircase.
Many veterans will admit that the experience of communal effort in battle has been the high point of their lives. I passes insensibly into a we. My becomes our. An individual fate loses its central importance. I believe that it is nothing less than the assurance of immortality that makes self-sacrifice at these moments so relatively easy. I may fall, but I do not die. For that which is real in me goes forward and lives on in the comrades for whom I gave up my life.
So what all of these cases have in common is that the self seems to thin out or melt away, and it feels good. It feels really good in a way totally unlike anything we feel in our normal lives. It feels somehow uplifting. This idea that we move up was central in the writing of the great French sociologist Emile Durkheim. Durkheim even called us homo duplex, or two-level man. The lower level he called the level of the profane. Now, profane is the opposite of sacred. It just means ordinary or common. And in our ordinary lives, we exist as individuals. We want to satisfy our individual desires. We pursue our individual goals. But sometimes something happens that triggers a phase change. Individuals unite into a team, a movement, or a nation, which is far more than the sum of its parts. Durkheim called this level the level of the sacred because he believed that the function of religion was to unite people into a group, into a moral community. Durkheim believed that anything that unites us takes on an air of sacredness.
Yeah, but you just talked over a really important line that anything that unites us is sacred. That we could spend a lot of time discussing. But what did you want to say before that?
Oh, when he says, that this is sacred, when he first asked, does anyone consider themselves religious?
Right.
And I raised my hand. And this is what I was talking about. I think an unformed religion where if you're doing something, if you're having a sacred experience in a group, that is religion to me, mm-hmm. where spirituality is internal.
But what is sacred? What does that word even mean? Like think of some synonyms. What would you say instead of sacred? Special, not normal.
Something tied to this is from. It would be tied to spirituality and religion, for me. Circular a bit, right? You have a sacred experience.
I'll project a little bit more where he's going with this, that we have evolved biologically to feel that when we're doing something that benefits us through our group, that we feel awesome. We have that really good feeling, and you can call it sacred, that we're engaged in something sacred, something that's bigger than ourselves, something that's more important than ourselves. And that is, that comes to us from our ancestors who evolved that way. And think about what's the greatest feeling in the world that you can achieve naturally? Probably an orgasm, right? And what are you doing in that moment? Why is your body sending you all these chemicals and rewarding you?
Oh, too many images, man. Yeah.
It's all around reproduction. This is your brain saying, this is the best possible thing that you could do for our survival. I mean, the point I'm trying to make, and tell me, is this just common knowledge that when we do things that are good for our survival, our brain rewards us? When we do things that are bad for our survival, our brain discourages us.
Say it again. Sorry, I had to finish this.
Our brain gives us chemical injections or whatever. it shoots chemicals through our body that tell us when we're doing something that's good for our survival or when we're doing something that's bad for our survival.
Oh yeah.
And maybe it's just like a depletion of things that make us feel good. We don't feel good. We feel bad. And that's our brain's way of going, knock it off.
More of this, less of this.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the.
And so like sex is what I was just saying at that one extreme.
Yeah.
When you're doing something that is good for the survival of life, the continuation of life, that's the best thing. So
yeah, I like that.
So
either you're immortal or you reproduce. Those are the only things your essence knows to do, right?
Well, I don't know about that. The only things, but when
no, you to survive, like, that's the only thing you can do to survive, either be immortal or reproduce.
Sure. Okay. Yes. Right. To overcome destruction.
Yeah.
That's what the brain wants. The brain wants to protect us. To sustain itself because it likes living. It wants to continue living. That's just what life is. And so, where am I going with this? When we do things that are beneficial for our survival, like be in a group and have strong group relations, it makes us feel good. I think that describes the Holy Ghost, the things that we felt with it as the Holy Ghost, that like, that this is this chemical reaction to this recognition that we are part of a group and that's good for our survival.
Well, I think that's right. Being Thomas the Tank Engine had it pretty
did he?
Had it right, where he just wants to be useful. We want to be useful.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's right.
All right. So let's go back to Jonathan Haidt because he's more articulate.
Once people circle around some sacred object or value, they'll then work as a team and fight to defend it. Durkheim wrote about a set of intense collective emotions that accomplished this miracle of e pluribus unum, of making a group out of individuals. Think of the collective joy in Britain on the day World War II ended. Think of the collective anger in Tahrir Square, which brought down a dictator. And think of the collective grief in the United States that we all felt, that brought us all together after 9/11. So let me summarize where we are. I'm saying that the capacity for self-transcendence is just a basic part of being human. I'm offering the metaphor of a staircase in the mind. I'm saying we are homo duplex, and this staircase takes us up from the profane level to the level of the sacred. When we climb that staircase, self-interest fades away, we become just much less self-interested, and we feel as though we are better, nobler, and somehow uplifted. So here's the million-dollar question for social scientists like me. Is the staircase a feature of our evolutionary design? Is it a product of natural selection, like our hands? Or is it a bug, a mistake in the system? It's just this religious stuff. It's just something that happens when the wires cross in the brain, and that's, you know, Jill has a stroke, and she has this religious experience. It's just a mistake. Well, many scientists who study religion take this view. The New Atheists, for example, argue that religion is a set of memes, sort of parasitic memes, that get inside our minds and make us do all kinds of crazy religious stuff, self-destructive stuff like suicide bombing. And after all, how could it ever be good for us to lose ourselves? How could it ever be adaptive for any organism to overcome self-interest? Well, let me show you. In The Descent of Man, Charles Darwin wrote a great deal about the evolution of morality. Where did it come from? Why do we have it? Darwin noted that many of our virtues are of very little use to ourselves, but they're of great use to our groups. He wrote about the scenario in which two tribes of early humans would have come in contact and competition. He said, if the one tribe included a great number of courageous, sympathetic, and faithful members who were always ready to aid and defend each other, this tribe would succeed better and conquer the other. He went on to say that selfish and contentious people will not cohere, and without coherence, nothing can be effected. In other words, Charles Darwin believed in group selection. Now, this idea has been very controversial for the last 40 years, but it's about to make a major comeback this year, especially after E.O. Wilson's book comes out in April, making a very strong case that we and several other species are products of group selection. But really, the way to think about this is as multi-level selection. So look at it this way. You've got competition going on within groups and across groups. So here's a group of guys on a college crew team. Within this team, there's competition. There are guys competing with each other. The slowest rowers, the weakest rowers, are going to get cut from the team. And only a few of these guys are going to go on in the sport. Maybe one of them will make it to the Olympics. So within the team, their interests are actually pitted against each other. And sometimes it would be advantageous for one of these guys to try to sabotage the other guys. Maybe he'll badmouth his chief rival to the coach. But while that competition is going on within the boat, this competition is going on across boats. And once you put these guys in a boat competing with another boat, now they've got no choice but to cooperate because they're all in the same boat. They can only win if they all pull together as a team. I mean, these things sound trite, but they are deep evolutionary truths. The main argument against group selection has always been that, well, sure, it would be nice to have a group of cooperators, but as soon as you have a group of cooperators, they're just going to get taken over by free riders, some individuals that are going to exploit the hard work of the others. Let me illustrate this for you. Suppose we've got a group of little organisms. They can be bacteria, they can be hamsters, it doesn't matter what. And let's suppose that this little group here, they evolved to be cooperative. Well, that's great. They graze, they defend each other, they work together, they generate wealth. And as you'll see in the simulation, as they interact, they gain points, as it were, they grow, and when they've doubled in size, you'll see them split, and that's how they reproduce and the population grows. But suppose then that one of them mutates, there's a mutation in the gene, and one of them mutates to follow a selfish strategy. It takes advantage of the others. And so when a green interacts with a blue, You'll see the green gets larger and the blue gets smaller. So here's how things play out. We start with just one green, and as it interacts, it gains wealth or points or food.
This is an important visual. Are you writing down something that was like inspiring to you? Or is it work?
You know, it was both of those.
Yeah.
It was very inspiring to me, which happened to relate to something that I had to do for work.
Okay.
Specifically save a man's life.
Yeah. Oh, because you're defending this guy. Yeah. So you had something that you're like, I've got to play on this.
Yeah. I've used Jonathan Haidt in the past in my closings.
Oh, right. I remember.
I think very effectively.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Well, let me back Smaller. This up because.
So here's how things play out.
I love this visual. And it, you know, we've talked about cultural membranes. This is where I got it from. Okay.
We start with just one green, and as it interacts, it gains wealth or points or food. And in short order, the cooperators are done for. The free riders have taken over. If a group cannot solve the free rider problem, then it cannot reap the benefits of cooperation, and group selection cannot get started. But there are solutions to the free rider problem. It's not that hard a problem. In fact, nature has solved it many, many times, and nature's favorite solution is to put everyone in the same boat. For example, why is it that the mitochondria in every cell has its own DNA, totally separate from the DNA in the nucleus? It's because they used to be separate free-living bacteria, and they came together and became a superorganism. Somehow or other, maybe one swallowed another, we'll never know exactly why, but once they got a membrane around them, they were all in the same membrane, now all the wealth created, the division of labor, all the greatness created by cooperation stays locked inside the membrane, and we've got a superorganism. And now let's rerun the simulation, putting one of these superorganisms into a population of free riders, of defectors, of cheaters, and look what happens. A superorganism can basically take what it wants. It's so big and powerful and efficient that it can take resources from the greens, from the defectors, the cheaters. And pretty soon, the whole population is actually composed of these new superorganisms. What I've shown you here is sometimes called a major transition in evolutionary history. Darwin's laws don't change, but now there's a new kind of player on the field, and things begin to look very different. Now, this transition was not a one-time freak of nature that just happened with some bacteria. It happened again about 120 or 140 million years ago when some solitary wasps began creating little simple primitive nests or hives. Once several wasps were all together in the same hive, they had no choice but to cooperate because pretty soon they were locked into competition with other hives. And the most cohesive hives won, just as Darwin said. These early wasps gave rise to the bees and the ants that have covered the world and changed the biosphere. And it happened again, even more spectacularly, in the last half million years, when our own ancestors became cultural creatures. They came together around a hearth or a campfire. They divided labor. They began painting their bodies. They spoke their own dialects, and eventually they worshipped their own gods. Once they were all in the same tribe, they could keep the benefits of cooperation locked inside, and they unlocked the most powerful force ever known on this planet, which is human cooperation, a force for construction and destruction.
And one of the things that Harari talks about in the book Sapiens, the way that they were able to achieve this cooperation was through intersubjective fictions, like religion. You know, religion's not the only way, but to have this code that everyone follows that binds people together in cooperation and becomes like this cultural membrane around people, which is where Haidt's going next.
Of course, human groups are nowhere near as cohesive as beehives. Human groups may look like hives for brief moments, but they tend to then break apart. We're not locked into cooperation the way bees and ants are. In fact, often, as we've seen happen in a lot of the Arab Spring revolts, often those divisions are along religious lines. Nonetheless, when people do come together and put themselves all into the same movement, they can move mountains. Look at the people in these photos I've been showing you. Do you think they're there pursuing their self-interest? Or are they pursuing communal interest, which requires them to lose themselves and become simply a part of a whole? Okay, so that was my talk delivered in the standard TED way. And now I'm going to give the whole talk over again in 3 minutes in a more full spectrum sort of way.
We humans have many varieties of religious experience, as William James explained. One of the most common is climbing the secret staircase and losing ourselves. The staircase takes us from the experience of life as profane or ordinary, upwards to the experience of life as sacred or deeply interconnected. We are homo duplex, as Durkheim explained. And we are homo duplex because we evolved by multi-level selection, as Darwin explained. I can't be certain that the staircase is an adaptation rather than a bug. But if it is an adaptation, then the implications are profound. If it is an adaptation, then we evolved to be religious. I don't mean that we evolved to join gigantic organized religions. Those things came along too recently. I mean that we evolved to see sacredness all around us and to join with others into teams that circle around sacred objects, people, and ideas. This is why politics is so tribal. Politics is partly profane, it's partly about self-interest, but politics is also about sacredness. It's about joining with others to pursue moral ideals. It's about the eternal struggle between good and evil, and we all believe we're on the good team. And most importantly, if the staircase is real, it explains the persistent undercurrent of dissatisfaction in modern life. Because human beings are, to some extent, hivish creatures like bees. We're bees who busted out of the hive during the Enlightenment. We broke down the old institutions and brought liberty to the oppressed. We unleashed earth-changing creativity and generated vast wealth and comfort. Nowadays, we fly around like individual bees exulting in our freedom. But sometimes we wonder, is this all there is? What should I do with my life? What's missing? What's missing is that we are homo duplex, but modern secular society was built to satisfy our lower, profane selves. It's really comfortable down here on the lower level. Come, have a seat in my home entertainment center. One great challenge of modern life is to find the staircase amid all the clutter, and then to do something good and noble once you climb to the top. I see this desire in my students at the University of Virginia. They all want to find a cause or call that they can throw themselves into. They're all searching for their staircase. And that gives me hope, because people are not purely selfish. Most people long to overcome pettiness and become part of something larger. And this explains the extraordinary resonance of this simple metaphor, conjured up nearly 400 years ago. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Thank you.
All right, what'd you think?
It's great. The thought I had is...
Put your video back on, please, sir.
Sure.
If you don't mind.
Happy to.
I like seeing your robe.
When you said I do like the robe, and I can show my tattoo that never gets attention.
Yeah.
When he was saying part of the, you know, what did he say? The continent, part of the continent, or the thing, the image that came to mind was we're all part of the ocean. Some people just look like icebergs. It's the same substance in a different form. And it's easy to say that is a separate from the other. And that is so different. And
yeah,
but yeah, man, I like, preach, Jonathan Haidt. So you got a chance to, he seems really like a real hopeful, positive guy.
That, wow. You were inspired to say that, because this was 2012, what we just watched.
Yeah.
So a couple of weeks ago with Michael, you know, sat down and they did an interview, and I don't know if I can play a clip from that or not. If I can play a clip from it, I'll play a clip from it. He's not as hopeful 5 years later as he was back then. Because he thinks that the ability of people to interact with each other and explore differences is a dying art. And that, like, parents have been really overprotective of their kids. He talks about this in the interview with Sam Harris too. Maybe I could use that clip.
Yeah.
The conversation.
So you think there's been a shift in 2012 that where he maybe was more hopeful that these things were going to happen and has seen it just evolve to a point where he sees it going the other way?
I think he's
that if we are evolving, that we're not evolving, we're devolving, we're killing ourselves.
Oh, I don't think he would say that we're devolving. I think that he would say that, and well, what he did say was we need to be more forgiving of each other. Mm-hmm. He could have built on this idea of a cultural membrane more in this video.
Yeah.
I think we talked about it more in the interview with Michael. But it's something that's been very interesting to me because of my background in folklore and all of the traditions and customs and culture that forms the essence of a cultural membrane. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. And when you have these different groups, some have very thin cultural membranes, some have very thick, robust cultural membranes like Mormonism. We talked about Mormons as being a high context folk group, which is the same thing as saying that they've got a really thick cultural membrane around them. It's made up of all so many things. Mm-hmm. But as they come into contact and conflict with others, something's got to give. You know, they're either going to like merge into one, or one's going to destroy the other one and, you know, take over what's left. But there's this constant struggle and push, and you see it all over the place now. And I think people's ability to peacefully merge their cultural membranes and become part of other cultural membranes, that skill isn't innate. It's not natural, and it's not being developed. People are being taught more that if somebody disagrees with you, then you have invalidated their lived experience, and that's a threat. And if that's a threat, you've got to be attacked, and there's retrenchment and narrow-mindedness, and you close yourself off instead of learning how to have healthy disagreements, respectful disagreements, where you can take the best of both cultures and merge together as one. It's more like, oh, we're heading towards conflict, and maybe we're already there and we're past the point of no return.
Yeah. Well, it recently, so I've made a very conscious effort to disconnect from politics. Aware, but trying to be aware on the periphery, I guess. I haven't been gotten it. You know, there's a number of things that have happened a little bit. I don't know details about, but I did read a David Brooks article, just recently about, for example, what the Republican Party has become, and it kind of advances this idea that at some point, once you've committed yourself to a group, that group continues to ask more of you, and it you either break from the group or you do what the group asks you to do. And this was specifically in context of the recent Republican embracing of Roy Moore, in contrast with Franken and some of the other reaction. But specifically, these people started by accepting Trump as a man, as a leader, and then embraced him with all his baggage and history and everything they said he was and know he was. They embraced him, and then they embraced his incompetence and his disrespect for the office and his disrespect for truth. They know better than that, but they ate it like an elephant, and now they're embracing someone who habitually targeted underage girls. They're embracing him. It's what the group has allowed. So that is all that I'm seeing. And it just seems to be reinforced. We say, how is it happening? How's it happening? And I guess my reaction is, yeah, of course. How is it not happening? How is it not happening more? I mean, as people are striving for connection and are yearning for it and feel disconnected from other people. They find connection through these profane things.
See,
and I don't know what is profane for, you know, I'm trying to discover what is connecting me that's profane rather than.
See, but here's where I think you're mistaken on it. Like, you call it profane because it's abhorrent to you. But if you're being consistent with the staircase model that Jonathan Haidt adapted from Emile Durkheim, what you're seeing is at the level of sacredness. It's at that level of group connection.
I understand. And so, it's what I choose to call profane.
Right. But if we're using profane and sacred in that Durkheimian sense, it's an incorrect use of the word profane. And that might cause misunderstanding. I mean, if what's really going on is there's this sacred experience that's connecting people together, and that connection, they're being rewarded, their brain is rewarding them because they're connecting with other people and they're in a group and the stronger groups win, and that's what's happening, then it doesn't really matter if we think that the things that are connecting them are good or true or not. It's functioning to make a connection, and they're feeling it. They're feeling that it's good.
Oh, yeah, we're saying the same thing.
Are we?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, where do you think we're disagreeing?
I don't know.
You seem to be very pedantic about this, whereas...
Okay. Well, it was just the use of the word profane, because you were saying it was a profane experience, and it's actually sacred.
I was using it in the way that Haidt used it at the end of his presentation there, that the way they're connected is they're connecting about profane things, is what he said. So when he was talking about them, talking about the groups continuing and what they're... I heard him distinguishing those two things, being connected amongst profane things.
I think what he said something about that society has been built to celebrate the profane, to celebrate the individual, and that's the world that we live in. And it's a world that has made us very skeptical.
So rather than use Haidt's language, I'll use my own language.
Yeah.
I believe that connection in whatever form elevates people. It dumps them with their brain chemicals, and they want to continue doing that. So just like we talk about the church and being or issues related to it, everything's trauma or connection, right? I mean, that's kind of how I see it. I don't want to be too dualistic, whatever, too much of a dichotomy, but I mean, that's how I think most things can be summed up, is you're either experiencing trauma, or some form of connection.
Yeah. So with the Roy Moore, is that his name? Roy Moore?
Rob Moore? Whatever. Roy Moore? Alabama dude?
Yeah, the Alabama dude. So do you see that then as elevating the people who are connecting around him?
I would be interested to hear. It must. And that's what creates, and it does. And the way it does is what they protect themselves by convincing themselves that's not reality. He is not the man. He is not. So that's the insulation that they provide. It elevates them and it connects them. And then it double connects them, because now they are even more righteous in defending an innocent man who's been falsely accused and falsely maligned because he just is defending their Jesus. So yes, I think it's incredibly connecting, not just to embrace him, but to defend him.
Right. And, but they're having this elevated group experience.
Yeah.
Through, and I think you can even see some of the defenses of him have been quoting the Bible about the age of, you know,
Mary and Joseph,
you know, things like that. So it's definitely tied into the sacred elevating experience. And then railing against that becomes an elevating sacred experience for.
So if we keep talking about out-group, in-group and these types of things. So is the goal then that we is to build a membrane around both? At some point you get to a point where you understand and can accept, at least, and forgive and feel empathy and connection towards.
That's my goal. That's my personal goal.
I think so.
That's the TBM whisperer goal. I mean, that's why, like, I feel like stepping back and going, okay, well, wait a second. If I'm if I'm responding to this as part of an in-group, I can see what that is. But if I try to pull myself out of that and just look at all of these different groups around the planet that are biologically, sociologically doing the same things, they're creating a cultural membrane around themselves for protection. And when that comes into conflict with other people, we're retrenching, we're getting angry. Like, what's the best way to do it? Shouldn't we celebrate and respect and honor anything that elevates people or at the act of elevation? And that sounds way too cultural, like relativism, mm-hmm. like anything is okay. And I don't believe that. I don't think that. I don't think that right. anything is okay. But
that's not the great, isn't that the great dilemma or the great
tension?
Yeah, because at some point you reach a point of both being able to accept, understand, and elevate that which would otherwise abhor you, right? On some level.
Maybe what it is we just have to like quit getting so distracted by things that aren't really as it, like we need to prioritize what are our biggest concerns.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
what things really matters.
Yeah, things like global warming. You know,
this is where the tension happens. It's very easy to say the thing that really matters is some sort of a justice position. I'm just human rights issue.
Yeah,
and so with that is my number one issue, and that's how I articulate it, and that's how I frame it, and that's how I frame elevation. Then that which comes in conflict with it becomes anti-elevation. And so, but the other person, their number one thing might be, that which comes in conflict
right.
with
right.
the human rights. And so now it becomes which one devours the other one, and the survival, the innate need to survive causes a different reaction. How do you get to the point when the perspectives of both are so in conflict, because everything you're saying, this language is imprecise. This language captures it, but can be spun very easily for everybody to say, yeah, yeah, yeah. Everybody believes they're elevated at every moment, even when they look back and realize they weren't. I certainly was. I certainly am. I always thought I was extremely enlightened and had some insights that others didn't, man.
I
look back, maybe, but I look back at what a dumbass I was before and how wrong I had it 2 years ago. I continue to gain perspective. And so that's the problem. There's that tension with the language and what that means. And it's easy just to flip it on its head and say, yeah, I'm doing that by doing something that's so divisive. But is there a way to be? Is there a way just to be and not be divisive, not have that conflict with other people, but still be principled, be your own cultural membrane, and bring in other people with the into your membrane, and you just is that possible?
Yeah. Of course.
But I think that's religion. I think that's what we're talking about. That's what
I think it's a lot of different things, and war and destruction is part of it, you know. And if 70,000 years ago, I think that's the date of the Enlightenment, or no, not like the. I'm thinking of the book Sapiens again, and talking about like the cognitive revolution when Homo sapiens. Boom, woke up one morning and had consciousness. No, you know, like evolved to this point where there was a shift over and we became aware of ourselves. And that's kind of when they are pointing to the birth of culture and things like that. 70,000 years. You think we're going to change something in 10 or 20 or 100 or 300? You know, I think we have been moving towards a global cultural membrane, but it doesn't come without conflict. It doesn't come without cost. It hasn't in this 70,000 year history. And why would we think that it's going to be any different over the next 70,000 years or however long it's going to take until we've either destroyed ourselves or come together and had like this one cultural membrane, and we go into some kind of a Star Trek world in the future where Earth is together and the others are the Klingons that are right out there somewhere. Well,
that would help.
That would help.
What we need is an alien invasion to actually make us global, like a global 911. But you know, people say, well, that's happening with climate change.
It is.
And I don't disagree with that. But yet, and it's so easy to make that the enemy. Make the enemy the enemy.
And maybe it'll be nuclear war. Maybe there'll be like nuclear war that wipes out, you know, the majority of the population. And then the people who are left go, man, we got to get our shit together and not do this, you know?
You know, I've been listening to this book, Three Bodies, and there was an interesting scene in it that just made me appreciate the reality of what you're saying. And it's talking about a guy taking a chainsaw and cutting down a tree. And another guy that's supervising comes over and asks, you know, how long has that tree been there? It's been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's grown through, you know, droughts and winds and storms, you know, for 300 years, and you came through as a man and cut it down in what, 10 or 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. The one thing that we've proven to ourselves is that man, sapiens, are capable of destroying things that have been built and fostered and successful for a long, 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 long time.
Yeah, that's a little bit too bleak for as a place for me to land, because what did they do with the tree?
What
did they do with the tree? What did they do with the tree that got cut down? And did they cut down the entire forest?
Listen, man, what I'm saying is man has created mechanisms to absolutely obliterate things.
Right.
These are not natural. You know, we're beyond just kind of, and we've got madmen that can do a lot of things. But here's the thing, man, it's not bleak. It's not bleak. Because the reality of that just makes it more important to find connections.
Right.
And to hit those brain chemicals as effectively and as elevating as possible, because it really is always now, and there may never be another tomorrow.
Yeah.
And that could happen from a nuclear disaster and these things, but it could also happen from a heart attack or from some stupid thing that's happened as well. And it sounds so cliche and it sounds silly, but at the same time, the reality of that truly does make me comfortable. And it's why I'm constantly seeking a state of death of ego, death of self, while I continue to elevate and find connections and be with other people that help me along my journey to elevate and to feel good and to feel useful and to be part of a group that perpetuates, that reproduces, man.
Yeah, right. You get that feeling. And for me, like this is my new, like I used to talk about the importance of putting things in the eternal perspective.
Yeah.
And this is kind of the new gospel for me, the new fictional
I keep saying
gospel that I'm creating.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and like I can recognize it's a fiction. It's an evolving fiction. I keep adding pieces to it and changing it, and reevaluating it. But it's all in this quest to better understand me, my place, and where I fit with people around me. And it's just in the last couple months, I think, recognizing that they're actually, I really do believe that we evolved in this homo duplex way to feel a sense of connection. And in leaving the church and even before I left the church, I felt like I was separate from it. You know, there were certain parts that I just couldn't accept about it. And I felt alone with it. And that is, so it wasn't feeding that upper duplex thing. I didn't feel that connection. And you know, then coming out of it and saying, oh, why am I not happier? You know, we've done the episodes before with Randy saying, am I happier? Am I not happier? No, we're not happier because we don't have that connection, but we've got this drive to do like an Infants on Thrones or other things where we're connecting with ourselves as a small group of friends, connecting with other people, with listeners. And so, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, I want to run towards that. And then I want to run towards that connection. I want to find those people that we can have a connection with and we can be enlightened together, whatever that means. And it can be different from what other people are doing. And like, I'd really like to get to a point to look at somebody, even if they're a Republican, and go, oh, you're enlightened by your stuff. That's awesome. That's where you should be. That's the healthiest place for you to be. That's where you are the most complete as a person, when you're getting that homo duplex stuff filled and not worry so much about the nitpicky points of how they're attaining that I disagree with, you know, because then I feel like it's promoting separation and disunion rather than union. And there's got to be some kind of a compromise along the way. But there also has to be hard lines where you go, okay, but not that.
Not that.
But not
right.
that. But
not
you don't
here,
treat every,
man.
You don't treat everything like it's that hard line. And I think that's part of the struggle that we're going through. And
well,
and
at some point, you talk about group and connection, but at some point that requires exclusion in order for the group to survive. And those who are ready, those who are, it becomes, judgments have to be made.
There must needs be opposition in all things. There must needs be.
There must needs be.
There must needs be opposition in all things.
Was it for every action, there is a, I think that's physics.
Opposite and,
I don't know. I don't know physics,
right,
man.
Right.
I'm so ill-equipped to address these topics.
Yeah. Sure.
All I know is what I feel, and I can't deny what I feel. Right?
We need like a really good like Kumbaya song to close off at this point.
Well, I'm reminded of a... never mind. It's two, we make a better day, just you and me. All right, let me hear you.
We are the world. We are the children. Hi, this is Hillary.
Matthew Ryan.
Carol.
Keith.
Dashley. And I like to play bingo online while listening to Infants on Thrones.
You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com.
And if you really like what you hear, give The Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes.
I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Infants on Thrones.